In the book of Revelation, we come across this summary of how big God's heart is. Every nation, every tribe, every people, every language. God has made a promise, okay? He has a plan. He has decided to provide for his son a bride, and that bride will consist of people. And he has promised that those people will come from every nation, every tribe, every people, every language. Some of those people will currently be enemies. I'm just thinking about the situation in the Ukraine. On the one hand, you know, totally divided country. Jesus says in his promise that there are people on both sides of that divide for whom the Savior died and on whose heart there's love from the Father, that he will bring them in, every nation, every tribe, every people, every language. It's an incredible vision. But it's hard to embrace. What are we going to do about this? You know, how on earth could we ever have something to do with a vision like that? Every nation, every tribe, every people, every language. It's especially true if you happen to be like me, who, if God called me to go to some other parts of the world, I'd die because I couldn't eat the food. You know, it's not meat and two veg. I can't eat it. If I can't recognize what's on the plate and what it came from, I can't eat it, all right? So I'm just so thankful to God he never called me to be a missionary. I'd be dead by now, or else I'd be living on Mars bars. It's okay, this idea, this vision of every nation, tribe, and people and language. That's great, but it takes in a whole pile of cultures and a whole pile of customs and a whole pile of food and travel and all sorts of other things that make it significantly challenging. How on earth are we going to do that? Well, the point is, God never meant us to do it alone. That was not the plan. He never meant us to do it alone, not at any level in terms of being a Christian. So in Acts chapter 1, whenever Jesus challenges the disciples and says to them, you know, wait in Jerusalem until you receive power, and when you do receive power, you will become my witnesses in Jerusalem, all Judea and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. When Jesus said that, you will be my witnesses, in the Greek language of the New Testament, you can tell that he said you plural. The problem is that in English, you is the same in the singular and the plural, unless you come from Northern Ireland, you say yous, which of course you shouldn't. When you're taught grammar at school, you were told that was bad grammar. But actually, whenever you mean plural, you could say yous, but good Bible translations don't use vernacular language like that. So you don't get the fact that when Jesus said, you shall be my witnesses, he used the plural form of you. He never envisaged the disciples would be on their own. When he sends his disciples out during his earthly ministry to teach and heal and cast out demons and raise the dead, what did he do? He sent them out in twos, not as individuals. And God never intended that we should do this work on our own, nor did he mean churches to exist in splendid isolation. He meant churches to work together and to be together in the service of his kingdom. Paul spent a lot of time giving the churches he planted a sense of connection. Paul lived in a day when it wasn't easy to keep contact and network with people who didn't live within easy walking distance of you. And Paul was going around planting churches all across the Roman Empire in what we now call Europe and in what we now call Asia, separated by large distances, by seas and mountains and cultures and all the rest of it. How were they ever going to feel a sense of connection? Paul tries to give it to them. He writes letters to them. In the letters, he tells them what other people are doing who are Christians. And he travels around and he takes people with him, young men especially, whom he is mentoring and training. And they come from one part of the empire and from one Christian church with Paul to visit all these other churches and ultimately to become leaders in some of them. So Paul was trying to connect congregations together. He was trying to connect them together so they could encourage one another and so they could share their resources. Now, in the church to which we belong, you're worshiping with us tonight, Carnmoney, even if you don't belong to us, you're really welcome to be here. We hope that you feel at home among us. But in this church here, we are connected. We are connected to all the other churches in our denomination. We are Presbyterian, and there are 546 Presbyterian congregations in the island of Ireland. And we're connected with them. And we're connected as well, not only with the work that we do individually as churches, us here in Carnmoney and the church in Cork You know, or us in Ballyhenry, or in Ballymoney, you know, we're connected together and we do stuff, each of us individually. We run organizational life. We gather people together for worship. We do evangelism. We're all busy and we're supporting and encouraging each other in doing it. But as well as that, we do some stuff together as a denomination. We do some stuff together. For example, all over Ireland, we're involved in training people. Right now, in 2014, 42 people, men and women, are being trained to be ministers in our denomination. 42 at the moment. And our church is getting together to do that. And those people are not trained in individual congregations. They're trained by the denomination grouping together. Youth work, all over Ireland at the moment, over 119,000 young people are in various youth activities organized by individual churches and by the denomination. And they are served by over 33,000 volunteers who are trained and vetted by the denomination itself. Social witness. Loads of stuff going on, but amongst the things we do in social witness as a denomination, we provide 445 places for the residential care of the elderly and people who are disabled. It's just some of the things that we do in Ireland, but we do stuff well outside Ireland as a denomination. For example, we have 40 missionaries right now working in 10 different countries doing things like development work, education, medical work, student work, evangelism. 40 people, 10 different countries. We saw the value of that a few years ago in church here when we connected with Derek and Linda Rolston in Galana, in Africa. And we saw how Derek went out there to run a kind of an agricultural project. And then that agricultural project grew into a community-based project that put up a school and a clinic and then a church and then built bridges across a river to keep children safe going and coming from school. This all started out of an agriculture project, and a farmer from Donegal hears God's call, is commissioned by the denomination, resourced and sent out to Africa to answer that call. We do these things together. And you can find out more about the things that we do together really easily. You get yourself a copy of Points for Prayer, which is a booklet that sets out all the stuff the church is doing to help you pray about it. And Reggie would be glad to find you one if you would like one. Or alternatively, you could go to this web address, www.presbyterianireland.org/prayer. You can sign up there for a daily email that will give you things to pray about in some of these areas I've just been talking about. In addition to all of that, the stuff we do on our own as churches, the stuff we do together as a denomination, we also partner with other churches overseas and Christian mission agencies, which means that instead of just working in 10 countries, we're working in 25 countries in partnership with them. It's not the whole planet. Okay, I get that. But it's an awful lot more of the planet than we would manage to reach if we had to do it on our own. There's a leaflet about this, and it's going to be available at the door afterwards, okay, when the service is over tonight. Please take a copy of it. It gives you more information than I can give you during the sermon. Summarizes some of the things the church is doing and what the money we give to the church is used to carry out in God's name. Please take it home with you. I didn't give it out to you at the start of the service because you only leave it in the pew, so I'm going to put it in your hand at the end, so you definitely take it home with you and have a read at it later. Now, of course, all the stuff we're talking about, well, you know where I'm going with this. It costs money. And it costs a significant amount of money as it happens. Last year, as a congregation here in Carnmoney, we spent £534,000. Okay, it's over £500,000 we spent on the work that we do, which is, whoa, that's a big sum of money. When you read it, you'll get a copy of the annual accounts next Sunday and to take home with you and have a look at. That's one of the headline figures from this year's accounts, £534,000. And of that £534,000, almost £59,000, a little bit over a tenth, went to the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. Half of that sum went towards administration costs, the kind of central costs of running the denomination, and also the costs of assisting congregations who are struggling to pay staff for themselves. So some of that money goes to help provide ministers in places who wouldn't be able to afford a minister without larger congregations supporting them to do so. That half of the funds, the other half of that half of the funds that does administration and staffing, that's one half. The other half of that £59,000 we gave, which finances this mission work in Ireland and throughout the globe that I described earlier, comes to the church through what we call the United Appeal for Mission. And when I tell you that last year we gave over £28,000 to that appeal, you would think to yourself, whoa, that's a big sum of money. But that £28,000 was less than 1% of the target that appeal needed to raise to finance the work I've just been talking about. That appeal needed to raise £3.25 million. So our £29,000 was less than 1% of that whole appeal. Which is why we can do so much more when we get together than what we can do on our own. Because if we did it on our own, we'd have 29 grand to spend. But when we do it with all the other congregations, we have £3.25 million to spend, and you can do a lot of damage with £3.25 million. The question is, will we? The question is, will we get involved in this work more and more? Will we make it a priority for ourselves? Will we see what the value is in being part of this larger group of people because we're Presbyterian? And Paul writes about this kind of thing in 1 Corinthians, in that chapter we read a moment or two ago. In fact, on at least three or four occasions in Paul's writings, he talks about this issue. These words crop up. He talks about, quote, the collection for the Lord's people. This was an offering Paul was encouraging the churches to make towards the poor in Jerusalem, okay? So Paul was going throughout the empire, and he was planting churches and seeing loads of people come to faith, and then he was encouraging those people who had come to faith to gather up money and funds that they could send to Jerusalem to support people there who were really poor. And in those verses we read a moment or two ago, he's encouraging the Corinthian Christians to do it, and actually they did do it. We find that out eventually in his letter to the Romans. And he tells them, in doing it, to use the same method that he'd already told the Galatians to use. So this wasn't just the Corinthians doing this. This was all the churches Paul planted. And he uses the example of one church to encourage the other. And he sees this giving, this collection for the Lord's people in Jerusalem, as a form of partnership. What was the partnership? These churches that Paul was planting in Corinth and in Galatia and in Philippi and Thessalonica and in all these other towns and cities that he visited, all these churches he was planting were Gentile churches. Most of the people who belonged to them were Gentiles, not Jews. And Paul was saying to these Gentile believers, how did you get to be a Christian? Answer to that question, because God worked through the Israelites. He incarnated his son as an Israelite. And that son lived and died for you, rose again from the dead. And then on the day of Pentecost, he gave to the church the Holy Spirit. And through the power and presence of the Holy Spirit, over 3,000 people came to faith on that Pentecost day. And they spread out through the Roman Empire, taking the story of the gospel with them everywhere they went. And all 3,000 of those people were Jewish Christians. So Paul is saying to the Gentile churches, look, God has blessed you and given you resources. You would not be in the kingdom if it was not for his work amongst the Israelite people through whom the gospel has come to you. Now, here's the partnership. Through them, you have received the unspeakable gift of God, unlimited, unmerited, and totally free. You have received the gift of God. Now, take the resources you have and give it to those people through whom you received that wonderful gift so that they too might be sustained. This was a partnership. And as he talks about this partnership in the gospel of Gentile and Jewish Christians, of those through whom the word of life had come, and then those through whom practical support and human comfort would come for the needs of the poor, as he talks about this partnership, he underlines some really key things about missionary support that I want to leave with you. And here's the first one. He says that missionary support needs to be habit. Habit. Paul says something here which takes me back to my childhood. I remember as a child we used to have envelopes in church. You know, they were smaller than the ones we use now. And they always had a scripture text on them. And the scripture text on them was this text, 1 Corinthians 16, okay, verse 2. On the first day of the week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with your income. Why did Paul say on the first day of the week? Why did he say that? Why did he not choose the third day of the week or the fifth day of the week or the seventh day of the week? Why did he choose the first day of the week? Well, you will know that the first day of the week was an important day for Christians. It was the day on which they celebrated and remembered the fact that Jesus Christ, their Lord and Master, who perished on the cross at Calvary, was raised to life again by the power of God. And on that resurrection to life of Jesus of Nazareth is based the Christian hope. We believe that Jesus is not dead. His body is not lying rotting somewhere in a grave in Palestine. We believe that he is alive and ascended to the right hand of the Father. And when the Father's purposes are fulfilled in the history of mankind, he's coming back and we shall see him as he is. And all our hope is based on that reality. And that's why the first believers met on the first day of the week to celebrate and rejoice what God had done through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Paul says, on the first day of the week, you do this. See what he's doing here? See what he's doing? He's making giving an act of worship. He's saying this is not envelope stuffing. This is not some passing fad when the collection plate comes around and you fumble in your bag or in your pocket for the smallest coin you have. This is an act of worship, a deliberate habit that you form in your life, that you sit down on the first day of the week to consider what you can give to God. Probably they didn't bring it to the church. Paul says they were to save it up. And then when he came, they were to bring it, and there would be one big offering. And Paul or one of representatives would be there, and they would receive it, and then they would take it on to Jerusalem. But the context of the offering was worship and rejoicing. They were to do it on the first day of the week, the Lord's Day. Not only that, but they were to do it proportionately. Each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with your income. Now, That translation is a really good translation for the 21st century. It works for our kind of life, you know, because we have an income and we know what the income is, and so we can sit down with that income and proportion it out. Many of the people to whom Paul was writing in Corinth were slaves. They didn't have an income, at least not a regular one. And so when Paul is talking about this, what is he saying? He's calling on the people as they think and reflect upon this gift to exercise some measure of proportionality, but maybe not in exactly the way that we would apply that nowadays. What he was saying here was that they need to sit down on the first day of the week and reflect on what God has done for them in the week that has passed. And then they make a decision in the light of that reality as to what they are about to save up to give for the purposes of the kingdom. You see the point? Even slaves had a bit of money, however small. In 12 Years a Slave, I don't know, I haven't seen the film, but I've finished reading the book. And in the book, it says that actually in the culture Southern America, Southern USA, where slavery went on, this Louisiana is where this particular slavery that you're looking at in the film is based. And in Louisiana, there was a tradition that slaves got time off on a Sunday. It was the only day of the week when they did. And any money that they acquired or earned through work they did on a Sunday was considered to be in addition to their normal chores and duties, and they were therefore allowed to keep that money for themselves. Not one penny piece of the money that they earned through their hard labor and that enriched the landowners of the slave plantations, not one penny piece of that for the other 6 days of the week did they get to keep. But anything they did on a Sunday, they got to keep. And that was how come Solomon was able to buy himself a violin, which meant that he was also able to use that violin to play on neighboring plantations and earn himself a bit of cash. Through that cash, they bought some small items of clothing, a little bit of extra food, small things that made a miserable life almost bearable. Even slaves of something. Very little 1 week and maybe a little bit more the next. Which is why Paul says you sit down each week and you reflect on what the week has been like. And when you have known the blessing and joy of God in your life, then you should give in proportion to that experience. The context of Christian giving is not what we think of the church or the minister or whoever, but how we have been blessed by God. It was never meant to be stuffing money into an envelope. It was always meant to be a response. And that's why God calls us to form a habit, to do this, to sit down and think about it. On the first day of the week, okay, maybe now in our culture where we don't tend to do this weekly, but we tend to be paid more monthly, then maybe this is a monthly consideration. It doesn't really matter. But the principle behind this is this, that on a regular basis, in a context of worship, as an act of response to the generosity of a God, the broken body and shed blood of whose Son we're going to take in our hands in a minute or two. In the context of the generosity of such a God, we figure out what we need to give. Ironically, you know, probably charity, if you give regularly to a charity, you're forced to do this because they ring you up, you know. You give them your phone number whenever you sign up, a direct debit or whatever, and so they phone you up every few months and they try to twist your arm. They've got a really good scam, which I've recognized now. When they come on the phone to start, that you have the usual pattern to get into the conversation. They ask you how you are and all the rest of it. You know what's coming next. And then they say to you, we really want to thank you for your generosity and your support for the work of the charity, but we've got these really big projects on at the minute. And you know we know that you're really interested in what we do. And we would just come on to ask you if maybe you would think about doubling what you give. And you think, what? Double it? Absolutely no way. I couldn't possibly afford that. Oh, well, we realize the times are stiff. Could you give an extra £2 a month then? It's a really clever ploy, you know, because it's dead easy to say, no, I couldn't possibly double it. But you're going to be so mean that you're going to turn down £2 a month, like. And so they force you to consider, how much does this mean to me? Is this important to me, the work of this charity? But nobody ever forces you to do that by church. And Paul says, if you don't form a habit, it'll never happen. You'll never think about it. Unless you sit down on the first day of the week and consider what you should offer to the Lord. It's one of the reasons why, in a monthly salary culture, we are trying desperately to encourage you to stop using envelopes and start using standing order giving. Why? Because if you're going to sign up a standing order, please don't do what you might be tempted to do. Okay, here's what you're going to be tempted to do. You're going to be tempted to look at what you've been given in the envelopes for the past 3 or 4 years, add it up, divide it by 12, and sign up to do that once a month for the next year. Okay, that's what you're going to be tempted to do. Please don't do that. Please do sign up for standing order giving. But forget about what you gave in the past. Sit down now and think, what has God done for me? What would be an appropriate response to that? And then make it a habit of reviewing that month by month as the time goes on. Standing orders are dead easy to change. If you've got internet banking, you can change them with a couple of clicks on the computer in your own home. You don't even have to go into the branch. Habit. Christian giving is about habit. But it's also about trust. If everyone in Corinth did this, okay, Corinth was a big church. It was growing fast. People were coming to it. Loads of people were finding faith in Christ. The church was rich in spiritual gifts. If you want to belong to a church in the early Roman Empire, you'd have wanted to belong to Corinth. That was someplace like. And if everyone in Corinth responded to Paul's appeal, there'd have been an awful lot of coinage to carry to Jerusalem. Okay, this was a day when there were no direct debits. There was no ability to pop into the bank and change the coins into notes, you know, or get some sort of a banker's draft that you could take with you down to Jerusalem or pop in the post. You couldn't do that. Basically, money was coins. And so all these coins would be collected up, and they'd have to be taken down. You know, I don't know about you, but I was saying to the kids this morning, we're collecting 20p and 5p. It's not the only thing we're doing, I hasten to add, but we're collecting 20p and 5p for our Hannah going on the trip to Uganda this summer. We're collecting Sterident tubes because they fit quite well in there. I said this morning, the Sterident tubes are not mine, okay? As my wife pointed out to me when I got home for lunch, they're not my wife's either, okay? But, you know, if you collect up a lot of coins, nowadays you can go into the bank and change them into cash, so you don't have to carry all these coins about. But you couldn't do that in Paul's day. So there was all these coins that people were saving up whenever the people would come. So how on earth were we going to get all these coins from Corinth to Jerusalem? It's quite a long way. Well, Paul says, when I arrive, I'll give letters of introduction to the men you approve. You're going to have to find some people from among yourselves that kind of stand out and whom you trust, and you're going to have to give the coins to them, and they're going to have to take them down to Jerusalem. It's going to take a number of people because there's a lot of money here. It's going to take a number of people because there's plenty to carry, because there's safety in numbers if you're going to carry this money across the empire in dodgy days, and because also it provides a level of accountability. So one of the people carrying the coins can't siphon a few off for some nice meals in a hotel on the way down to Jerusalem, okay, because there's some other people there to keep an eye on it. So you need to get people to do it. But here's the interesting thing. Amazing, really, in some ways. They were going to have the privilege of gathering up all this coinage. They were going to have the responsibility of selecting people whom they knew would be a safe pair of hands to take this money down to Jerusalem. But they didn't get to decide what the money got spent on when it came to Jerusalem. And that runs so countercultural to so much Christian giving. See, because there's some people in Corinth, they would be thinking when they brought the coins in, now when this money gets to Jerusalem, I only want it spent on youth work. I don't want it wasted and doing all sorts of things. I want it to be spent on youth work. And somebody else was saying, no, I don't want it to be spent on youth work. We spend far too much money on youth work. I want it to be spent on work with the elderly. Okay, and somebody else was saying, no, I don't want it done anything like that. I want it to be spent on evangelism, getting out into society, winning people to Jesus Christ, and I don't want it spent on anything else. My money, and that's what I want it spent on. That's what we do in the church all the time. Paul didn't give anybody an option to do that. He said they had to trust. They had to trust the people in the church to whom they were sending the cash. They were the people on the ground. They knew the needs in Jerusalem far better than people living in Corinth, which was a totally different culture hundreds of miles away. How could they possibly know what the needs were in Jerusalem? They got the privilege of giving the gift, but they had no responsibility or control over the decision of how that money was spent. Earmarking is a curse. Curse Christian work. I do some work for the presbytery on the financial side, and at the moment congregation statistical returns are coming in, and I'm taking figures out of it to summarize some stuff for the meeting on Tuesday night. And I noticed this one rather staggering fact that I hadn't seen before. There are 23 congregations in the Presbytery of North Belfast and Newton Abbey. And in their bank accounts at the end of 2013, those 23 congregations had exactly £5.5 million. Unspent. £5.5 million. Now, some of that money was there for good reason. 400 grand of it's ours, put by for the building project. Okay? So we're saving that up for a special project. And some of the other monies that would be included in that would be of a similar character. But a large amount of that money doesn't fall into that category. Do you know how it comes to be there? It comes to be there because it was given by people to do a certain thing in the life of the church. And they can't spend that money on that at the moment. So it's sitting there and it can't be used for anything else. So much so that there's one congregation in the presbytery that right now cannot pay their daily bills, their salary costs, their heat and light, just the ordinary things of everyday payments in church. And during the course of the year, to keep themselves afloat, they had to take money out of their property fund to pay bills. They're going to be in trouble for that now. Because somebody's going to say, we didn't give you the money to do that. We give you the money to spend on property. Hey, we haven't got anything to spend on property, but we can't pay for heat and light. Earmarking is a curse. Which is one of the reasons for encouraging those who are going to give to church here by standing order to allow discretion to the committee through its treasurer to direct the funds you give to where they are most needed right now. You'll see when you sign up that that's there. You can opt out of it if you like and insist, if you want to do so, on telling us how exactly you want it spent. Or you can choose to allow the committee to direct those funds to where they're most needed right now. And I'd appeal to you to do that. Because it means that we can do that then. The United Appeal for Mission that we're talking about here. Last year, we had to raise just over £28,000, okay? And it's hard for me to tell you what that £28,000 does, to encourage you to give to that appeal. Because it gets spread over this bucket, which eventually fills up with £3.25 million, you know, and our 28 grand's in there somewhere, and it's doing all these things. But I can't give you one project that it finances, because it doesn't. It just becomes part of this large pond out of which all this life comes. And so it's quite hard, in a sense, to sell it, because maybe if it was a project and it was something like we're doing in Galana, and I could say to you, our 28 grand would build half a school, but if we gave 56 grand, we could build a whole school. I'm sure there's loads of you who'd say, let's try and get the 56 grand and build a whole school. But if I say to you, our 28 grand goes into a big pot along with lots of other money, and I can't tell you exactly what it does, you might say, well, I don't know whether I want to give to that. We need to trust the people to whom we give the funds, that if we give them, they can use them to do mission work right now, somewhere across this planet, and it'll make a difference to somebody's life because you give that money. Trust. Can't work without trust. We have to acknowledge the fact that there are people closer to the coal face where the needs are, who know better than we do what needs to be done right now, and we should allow them to make those decisions in God's name. Of course, there are reports and auditors, and you can read all those things if you want and find out where every single penny went. It's all there, and you can have access to it if you want to. But let them be free to use it. We need to trust. And lastly, we need to understand that it's a gift. We need to see how Paul sees this work. Paul says, send the men you approve with your gift to Jerusalem. This money was a gift and not a tax. Hands up, everybody who loves paying tax. Okay, nobody. Fine, that's great. We hate tax. We don't want to pay it. It's one of the most those onerous things. You get your pay slip at the end of the month or the end of the week, and you look at what the government takes off you, and it makes you feel grumpy. Because nobody likes taxes, all right? And if we begin to think about giving to the work of God like a tax, then we'll think about it in the same way, and we'll do everything we can to dodge as much of it as possible. And that's part of the problem. The administrative and staffing element of the payments we make to the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, I mentioned earlier, that first half, they actually are a tax. They are calculated on our income and our ability to pay. They are removed by direct debit from our bank account, and we can't do anything about it. Okay, so half of that money really is a tax. Now, the reason why it's done that way is because it's an efficient way to do it, and it's like a membership fee. If you belong to a golf club or a trade union, there's a membership fee. And that kind of 29, 30 grand is like our membership fee. Okay, it's probably more than you pay to the golf club, but there's a lot of us, all right? But the other half, the missionary half, is a gift. We are given a target. But the money is not taken by direct debit from our bank account, and it only goes if we give it. It only goes if we give it. Christian giving is exactly that, okay? It's a gift, not a payment. It's an offering, not a tax. See, there's something really important you have to remember. God does not need our money. Okay? God does not need our money. There isn't anything I have that he needs. How could there be? He's the eternal one. Everything that I see, he made. You know what? What could I possibly give him that he needs? And so I don't have to make payments to God, because if I fail on my payments, God's going to be shortchanged. He's not going to be able to afford something he wants because I haven't coughed up. It's never going to happen. So the only reason that I would want to do this is because I want to do it as a gift. He accepts our offerings. You know, our offering is like that alabaster jar of perfume that the woman poured over Jesus' feet in Luke chapter 7. Jesus didn't need the perfume. Why would he need it? His feet were clean. He didn't need her tears. But when she came into the room that night and she cried all over his feet and she wiped them dry with her hair and she opened and broke the little alabaster bottle of expensive perfume, so expensive, and she broke it and poured the whole lot out over him. He didn't need that. But he accepted it as an offering. It was a gift from her. Because you see, the character of our practice is what really matters. It's not the amount we give. Whether we can be as extravagant as that woman with this precious jar of perfume, or whether we just give those two little coins that the woman gave in the temple as Jesus watched at the treasury one day. The point in each of those cases was not the amount of money, not the expense of the perfume or the pathetic value of the coins. It was the heart of the person making the gift. In each case, the person gave everything they had. And God accepted the offering. And here's the question the psalmist asks. What shall I return to the Lord for all his goodness to me? You can never repay a faithful spouse. You can never give back to your parents or to your children what they give to you. You just can't do it, because what human love provides is beyond price. You cannot put a value on it. It would be truly impossible, no matter how rich you were, be able to pay back someone who has been faithful to you. All you can do is give them a gift. I don't mean by that pathetic thing we sometimes do where we give a lousy gift and then we say, but it's the thought that counts. I don't mean that. I mean that when you truly love someone, you try to pick a gift which is as much and maybe sometimes more than you can really afford. But because it is a gift that is meant to say thank you, it's meant to say I love you, it's meant to say I appreciate so much all that you have been to me. It's a gift, and we have to give it. You know, God isn't interested in your money. Some people here tonight, and you don't need to give God money, you need to give him yourself. You've been scouting around the question for so long. I was a young woman came to me this morning. I talked to her husband just a couple of weeks ago, and he told me that he'd given his life to Christ. His wife came to me this morning to tell me that on Monday night of this week she gave her life to Christ too. That's the third married couple in the last few weeks I have seen God bring both partners to faith in himself. It's an incredible story. They didn't need to give God money. They just needed to give God themselves. And there's some of you here tonight, and that's what you need to do. You need to give God yourself. You don't need your money. But then when you give him yourself, you want to go on giving to him to reflect the joy in your heart for what he has done to you. You know, there's something which is infectious about giving. Any of you men who were at M13 last autumn remember something that Alan Scott did in one of the sessions at the conference. He stood at the front, and he looked down at the audience and he said, is there anybody here who would give me £20? And you know what the reaction was? Everybody's looking at each other and thinking, £20? What does he want £20 for? I'm not giving him £20. I don't even have £20. So, and it was kind of like a silence and a bit of, and then he said again, can anybody here give me £20? And so eventually, some idiot gets up from his seat, goes up to the front, and hands Alan £20. And Alan says, thank you very much. And the fellow goes back to his seat and he holds a £20 note up and he says, is there anybody here who needs £20? Well, an even longer silence then. Like, who's going to be man enough to get out of there? I mean, even if you needed the £20, are you actually going to have the courage to get up out of your seat and go up to the front of the and take the £20 note from him? But somebody did. Somebody got up, walked down to the front, took the £20 note, said thank you to him. And Alan said, can anybody give me £10? And a little bit shorter time this time, somebody comes up with £10, does the same thing again. Anybody need £10? And sure enough, somebody came and took the £10 note. And then he asked again, anybody give me £10? But by now, people were getting their wallets. I had my wallet out looking to see if I had a £10 note. I wanted to go up to the front and give him the £10 note. I didn't have a wretched £10 note in my wallet. Couldn't anyway, somebody else beat. Now there was three or four people coming up with £10 notes. Because giving is infectious. Once we start to give to God, and once we start to get a different attitude to stuff like that, then it catches on, and other people want to do the same thing. Because we're giving now. We're not paying a tax. We're giving to God. And that's the challenge. That's the challenge. This is a gift. Can you seriously tell me that what you've been putting in an envelope or given to the life and work of this church is an adequate reflection of how you feel about God? Really? Is that the best you can do? Because that's the challenge to us. It's why we'd love you to think about standing order giving, because it forces you more regularly to think about what you're doing and how the Lord has blessed you and how you can release resources so that His church can grow and do amazing things. In terms of United Peel, I'm talking about tonight, this year we need to raise at least £37,000 to pay the church house, what will go on to support the wider work of our denomination, and the £9,000 we have committed towards the support for Lindsay Bell. And then we'll do other stuff on top of that. But we need 37 grand to start with, okay? And I'd love you to think about that, especially if you're an envelope giver, because you have those little envelopes in different colors, and one of your envelopes is United Peel and Mission, all right? Now, I don't want you to stop putting money in the other ones, so you can put it all in the United Peel and Mission, because they need the funds as well. But I want you to think about this one. Today, throughout the whole of Ireland and PCI, it's United Appeal Sunday, they're thinking about these same questions. Other brothers and sisters of ours are considering whether or not they're doing right by God. What about us? What about us, especially in the light of the fact that in a minute or two, we're going to distribute bread and wine. We're going to hold in our hands physical representation of what it cost God to give you a chance of a new life. He paid with the precious blood of Christ. What are we going to do, you and me?